How many physicists do you think it takes to fix the world's biggest particle collider?
Is this one of your physicist jokes?
I think it might be. And I actually have no idea what the punchline would be. But I can tell you this. The giant machine broke down last fall and high energy physics went on hold. Now, Europe's high energy physics lab, CERN, has announced plans to restart the collider. And NPR's Jeff Brumfiel is going to tell us all about it.
If you want to see something really new in high energy physics, you've got to go big, and that's where the Large Hadron Collider comes in. The LHC is nearly 17 miles around. It accelerates ordinary particles to near the speed of light and smashes them together. Researchers hope that studying the subatomic shrapnel from those collisions will bring them closer to a theory of everything. It might also reveal other things like dark matter. That's the strange stuff that glues galaxies together. The LHC is vastly complicated, which is why it's so amazing that last September, scientists got particles whizzing around the ring on the very first try.
Okay, three, two, one, go.
Two spots! Fantastic! That's really fantastic.
It all went so smoothly that researchers were expecting the particles to start colliding right away. Joe Licken is a theoretical physicist at Fermilab near Chicago.
We were actually betting on when the first collisions would happen. We had a pool going on whether it would be tomorrow or next week or 2 weeks from now.
9 days later, all bets were off. A faulty connection caused a massive electrical short. Repairing the mess has taken most of the year. Now, to understand what this means for high-energy physics, you have to understand that the LHC is pretty much the only game in town. Fermilab also has a working collider, but it's only a fraction as powerful. That makes it a lot harder to find the really cool stuff everyone wants to study, like dark matter.
It's very disconcerting for all of us in terms of planning our lives. We want to be there when the exciting things are happening, but we can't afford to just hang around in Geneva forever and wait for years and years for these things to come up and run.
Top researchers can go work on something else for a while, but junior scientists need the LHC.
The people that it really hurts are the young people, especially the graduate students, who were hoping to have LHC data to analyze in order to finish their PhD theses and become famous and get jobs.
Don't let me say anything that destroys my career.
That's Sarah Lockwitz. She and her husband are both graduate students at Yale. They moved near Geneva to be closer to the collider. They needed its data to finish their PhDs. But the delays have made that impossible. So this summer, they made a big decision. They left Switzerland for Illinois to get data from the smaller collider at Fermilab.
On the Geneva side, we had to sell everything for, you know, pennies on the dollar or pennies on the euro or whatever you want to say to try and get out of there in a couple of weeks. And we just came over with two suitcases and landed and realized, like, the car we left behind didn't work. So we used cash for clunkers and got a new car and drove over to Chicago.
They're not alone. An increasing number of American graduate students are moving back to Fermilab. Others are just having to wait. It's not ideal, says Joe Licken.
We shrug our shoulders. What else can we do? You don't just switch on a machine like the LHC and have it run smoothly on day one. It's just not the way these things work.
When the LHC switches on again in November, it'll be at energies too low to see very much. But for the waiting physicists, low energies are better than no energies. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
Cash for clunkers is not only supposed to boost the auto industry and the economy, it's also supposed to benefit the environment. All this month, we'll be examining some of the things Americans are doing or buying to preserve the environment and curb global warming. Today, in the first of our series, NPR's Christopher Joyce takes on this question: is trading in your old car for a new one as helpful to the planet as it might seem?
Robert Hemsley was one of the first customers to take advantage of the cash for clunkers deals offered at Sheehy Auto Stores in Annapolis, Maryland. Hemsley said he wasn't thinking about the environment when he went to the showroom.
Just saving money, staying alive, making a buck, paying my bills. I had a Chevy van, 97, I guess 12 years old, 224,000 miles, and it got 14 miles to the gallon.
Hemsley used his government voucher to buy a Nissan Cube, which gets about 30 highway miles on a gallon of regular. He says he'll cut his gas costs by almost two-thirds. But even before Hemsley drove out of the lot, his new car had actually added carbon dioxide, or CO2, to the atmosphere. That's because it takes electricity to make a new car and fuel to ship it.
The estimates vary, but it's somewhere between 3 and, say, 12
tons of CO2 are produced for every car you make.
William Shimides runs the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. He says you have to drive a while before you save enough fuel to offset that new car carbon.
Our estimates are, depending on how much you drive, of course, that it's going to take you years or so.
For example, he calculates that if you trade in an 18-mile-per-gallon clunker for a 22-mile-per-gallon new car, it would take about 5.5 years of typical driving to offset the new car's carbon footprint.
On the other hand, the cash for clunkers deal for trucks, you're really beginning to talk something like 8 years to make it up.
Engineer Chris Hendrickson at Carnegie Mellon University pioneered the calculation for the carbon costs of a new car. It's called a life cycle analysis, and he says you have to cast a wide net to capture the true footprint.
That includes both the manufacturer, the assembly itself, but also the supply chain associated. Things like manufacturing the batteries, manufacturing the tires, transporting all those components around.
Of course, the bigger the mileage improvement from your old car to the new one, the more gas you save and the faster you work off the new car's carbon footprint. If you trade in a 20-mile-per-gallon car for a Prius that gets about 50 miles per gallon, it saves so much gas that you can offset the Prius's footprint in about a year and a half. But a 20-mile-per-gallon car does not qualify as a clunker, so no government voucher. And people with big cars tend to be buying new cars that are still pretty big, according to an executive at GE Auto. He says more of their customers are opting for modest trade-ups, close to the 4-mile-per-gallon minimum improvement that's allowed for cars. Other auto analysts say they're seeing plenty of deals for new cars that get 10 miles a gallon more. But either way, it's not enough, says Dan Becker of the Safe Climate Campaign.
The problem is the auto industry hijacked this law so it doesn't get the better ones on the road. All it does is replace old clunkers with new clunkers.
Becker says the Cash for Clunkers program isn't creating a market for the most fuel-efficient cars. He notes that the original legislation had tougher mileage requirements, and he says the government would have done better by subsidizing people who buy cars that are 25% more fuel-efficient than the kind they're driving now. Even SUVs would qualify.
So you could, for example, buy a Ford Escape Hybrid, not something to sneeze at, and you'd trade in a clunker and drive off with a much more efficient vehicle.
Environmental analysts point out that only 2 years from now, new cars are supposed to get an average 27 miles per gallon. That's 5 miles better than required for the Cash for Clunker program. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
A deadly form of malaria has something in common with HIV/AIDS. Both appear to have jumped to humans from chimpanzees in Africa. That's according to a new genetic study of the origins of what's known as malignant malaria. NPR's John Hamilton explains.
Malaria kills more than 1 million people each year. It's spread by mosquitoes carrying parasites that cause the disease. And a parasite called Plasmodium falciparum causes the most dangerous form of malaria.
It's a very, very nasty disease.
Francisco Ayala of the University of California, Irvine, has spent the past 15 years trying to trace the origin of the falciparum parasite. He says people who grow up in areas where it is common develop some immunity. But everyone else is very vulnerable, including scientists like the famous geneticist William Hamilton. He was in Africa a few years ago doing research on the origin of HIV.
The sad story is he got bitten, he got infected with malignant malaria. 3 days later, he was dead. That's why falciparum malaria is feared.
But scientists couldn't figure out where the parasite came from. Dan Hartle, a biologist at Harvard, says there was a lot of confusion.
The earliest data suggested that human malaria might have come from birds.
That was based on a genetic analysis that showed similarities between parasites carried by birds and those in people.
Everybody was a little skeptical of that result, but that's the way the data were pointing at the time.
Ayala was among the skeptics, so he had his team begin studying parasites carried by chimps. First, they discovered a parasite that was much closer to falciparum than the bird parasites. Then they tried to figure out whether this parasite had infected a common ancestor of humans and chimps millions of years ago, or whether the chimp version had jumped into humans more recently. His team took samples of parasites from chimps and humans and studied regions of DNA in which mutations tend to accumulate at a known rate.
Because they are timekeepers.
The regions act as a sort of genetic clock. The longer a parasite has been around, the more mutations it acquires. Ayala says his team found that the chimp parasite, called Reichenaui, had a lot more mutations than the human parasite, Falciparum.
Indicating thereby clearly that the Reichenaui is the ancestor of Falciparum. At some point, there was a transmission from a chimp to a human.
Hartle says the finding offers a major revision of malaria's history.
It suggests that there was a single transfer from chimps to humans, and that it surely occurred well within the last, let's say, 100,000 years.
And perhaps quite recently. Scientists say it's only in the past 10,000 years or so that nomadic people in Africa began to settle down and cultivate the land. That meant denser populations and standing water, the conditions that make it easy for mosquitoes to transmit parasites from one person to the next. Hartle says Ayala's version of events makes sense to him.
This brings the human malaria picture into consonance with what we know about other monkey and primate malarias.
As well as what we know about diseases including HIV. And that should make it easier to come up with better medicines or a vaccine. The malaria research appears in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. John Hamilton, NPR News.